People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, punk rock saved my life. We'll hear about Jason Scherz's punk journey through mental health and a bit about his punk rock journey through Vancouver Island. Plus, supportive housing that works for every community. I'll chat with a pair of supportive housing CEOs about some ways they feel the systems in place could be set up to better serve everyone. Welcome to People First Radio. Picture this. Someone screaming at you as loud as they can for 45 minutes. For most people, that would be the stuff of nightmares. For author Jason Scherz and members of the punk rock community, it's therapy. That's what you'll find on the back cover of Scream Therapy, a punk rock journey through mental health. It's a new book from Powell River's Jason Scherz. It tells the story of how his lifelong membership in the punk rock community helped him navigate through things following a mental health crisis and a bipolar diagnosis in his late 40s. Scream Therapy and the podcast of the same name take on myths and misconceptions both about punk music and mental health, mixed in with a ton of Vancouver Island flavor. The story's framed around a punk tour of the island that Scherz was part of in 2018. It included stops in Nanaimo, Gabriola Island, and Victoria, among other places. I had the chance to speak with Jason Scherz about the power of punk. Punk rock saved my life is a phrase you'll see often in your book. Can you tell me a bit about the first time maybe you thought that about yourself?
Yeah, I think I lived in a small town. I was growing up here. I'm actually back here now as an adult. And something just didn't feel right. I couldn't find anybody that I really related to. I couldn't understand my surroundings. It didn't seem like it fit with the way that my mind worked. And I think when I discovered punk rock through a friend, one of the only maybe five people in town that even knew what punk rock was, it just opened up my world because the bands were singing about things that I was searching for, whether that was social justice issues or issues around identity and community. And those things just weren't part of my upbringing because this place is was a very mill-centered, logger-centered, hockey player-centered town. And there wasn't anything for me here. And so I guess that, yeah, it was just a question of finding that through this friend. And then it really opened my eyes up to that world. And I think when I say it saved my life, I use it metaphorically. You know, I don't know where I would be if it wasn't for that music, for that scene. I'm not saying I would be dead. Some folks in the book do say, you know, punk rock really saved my life, literally. But I think that ultimately for me, it was just that whole new perspective and knowing there was something out there that I could be excited about and to be feeling like there's potential there for me to be a better person.
You really get a sense of like the ethos of punk rock from reading this book. For someone who hasn't had that experience and isn't already a big punk fan, how would you sum up kind of what punk means?
Well, I think when it comes to the core of it, it's about being yourself and not feeling like you have to conform to different parts of society that maybe don't fit for you. It could be anything from, you know, wanting to save postage by, you know, like waxing your stamps back in the day and being able to get your stamps back from people and reuse them because you don't want to support Canada Post or whatever. It could be veganism. It could be being straight edge, not drinking and doing drugs. It could be looking at different forms of life, different forms of being with people. You know, do we have to always be talking bad about people in our lives? Can we shift that and look at the positive? Punk rock is, to me, about those things. For some people, punk rock has a connotation to the negative, which I've never understood, but I do get that there are people out there that, you know, have a different persuasion that also listen to punk. For me, punk was more a way of life, not so much a music style, although the music I listen to predominantly is punk and metal. To me, it was a way of life. And yeah, that's how I would describe the ethos from my point of view. It's just about doing it your own way, doing it in a way that seems authentic to you. For me, I always talk about feeling alive. So when I'm feeling most alive, that means I'm in my punk mode. And when I'm feeling like I'm conforming or compromising or going against my ethics or just feeling like, ugh, instinctually wrong about something, I'm losing my punk spirit.
The book is structured around a tour you made of Vancouver Island. You were the only fixed member of a punk improv band, and you really let loose. There were stops here in Nanaimo and on Gabriola Island. Maybe a fun way in would be to focus on the positives of that trip. And I think the one that stood out was a show on Cortez Island. Can you tell me a bit about what made that so special?
There's this leap of faith in booking punk rock shows because it's not done in a traditional way, using a booking agent or using a big venue and the kinds of shows that a lot of people think of. With this show, it was a real leap of faith. I'd heard from somebody that Cortez was really cool. Someone that actually lives here in Powell River had turned me on to Cortez. I'd never been there before. I found this guy who started corresponding with me, who was in a local band. He was quite a young guy in his teens. He was really excited about us coming. It just, this excitement just builded and builded. And I didn't know for sure. I had a feeling that it was going to be a really special show. But we walked into this beautiful old, you know, 1920s built hall, all made out of wood and just amazing looking place, and thought, uh-oh, this is, are we going to destroy this place? And then all the people that showed up, I mean, I would say 75% of the people that showed up were teens and young adults, whereas a lot of the shows that I've gone to have, you know, older folks, and it felt this energy, and they were so excited, and they just were so stoked to see a show coming, and a punk band was playing. And I guess I'd heard there hadn't been a punk show there for quite a while, maybe up to a year or more. And it was this young guy's band's first show, so people were just so excited to see their friends play in this show. And it's just that feeling, like I compared it in the book to like a punk rock kumbaya, which sounds really cheesy, and but it's true. I mean, we all hung out outside. There was a fire. We came into the venue. We screamed our faces off. People were stoked. Everybody had their own dance moves. Nobody had phones. There's no cell service on Cortez in that particular area, so nobody had phones. It's just like, whoa, where am I? This is amazing.
Yeah, that's super interesting to me to hear about the lottery of booking a punk show. Like, can you tell me what the punk scene is like across Vancouver Island?
It's pretty tight-knit. I think a lot of the bands that are in Nanaimo and Victoria do have that connection back and forth. Bands often will play Nanaimo, Victoria, sometimes Campbell River or Port Alberni. Pretty rare. I mean, the tour that we did in the book is I picked some pretty like off the beaten path places that hadn't had a lot of punk shows. And I think that was my idea, maybe a bit of a misplaced idea, that we could go and play all these tiny little places. And ultimately, maybe it was a question of maybe the wrong venue in some cases. But I think that, yeah, there's a huge connection across the island. If you have a band in Courtney, or you have a band in Euclid, and you're going to have a connection with somebody else in Vancouver Island to play a show in Victoria or Nanaimo. I think also there's always been this idea of Vancouver Island being this real weirdo punk scene. The bands from Vancouver Island traditionally tend to be a lot more bizarre in some ways. I think the reason being is because No Means No were just such a huge influence on Victoria punk rock, and they were a very strange band, and you know, they were way out there, and I think that kind of trickled down. I wouldn't say it's Vancouver tends to be a bit more not traditional, but Victoria has this really strange style of music for punk, and I think that kind of filtered out to the whole island in some ways.
And the tour that you're going on, it's kind of framed as, looking back on it in retrospect, you kind of wonder, is this tour performing as this character, the punk screamer who really lets it all out and lets loose? You write as if that's something that's very cathartic, that is helping you to maybe keep things on the rails a bit. Can you just tell me about that idea, the relationship on that tour of performing and just your general mental health and using it as a release?
I think as things are escalating in my life, it became harder and harder to find outlets to process or at least stave off, like, what I didn't realize at the time was going to be this huge mental health crisis. And being this being in this band, Punk Jams, with all these friends of mine playing improv music, there was no barriers, there was no holding back. And it allowed me to be this person that I wanted to be in order to feel like I could be safe. Sounds weird, because there's a lot of stuff in the tour where I was wrapping microphone cables around my neck, or I was covered in bruises, or, you know, I was jumping off of things and hurting myself. But it was almost as if I had to do something to keep what was really brewing inside at bay. And yeah, it was super fun. It was super exciting. A lot of it is just black. There's so much of that tour that isn't up here in my head because of the fact that I was really dissociating and really going into this other, call it a persona or other part of me. And yeah, it was just chaos. And, you know, I think in the book, it does capture that. I think the key to that part of the book is that that was the protector. It doesn't seem like it is as you read it, but ultimately that character was my protector. And, you know, the character allowed me to essentially stay safe, but there's dichotomy there between staying safe and then doing all that wild stuff. Yeah. And that's also kind of why I went on tour, was to try to find a place where I could not get away from my problems, but try to figure out a way to at least deal with them in some way. And of course, there's a expiration date on that kind of coping mechanism.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Jason Schurz. We're discussing his new book, Scream Therapy, A Punk Journey Through Mental Health, which he'll be launching this Sunday at Window Seat Books in Nanaimo and on Tuesday at Camus Books in Victoria. And you alluded to the fact that the tour is maybe a precursor is a weird word, but shortly after there was a bit of a crisis for you. What would you like people to know about your story and that part of it?
I think you have to find ways to not just cope with mental health issues or stress or trauma or things that are happening in your life that are causing you to escalate in a way that maybe you're not either comfortable with or maybe don't understand. And so I think it's more about than just coping. I mean, you can cope with any kind of behavior. In my case, it was, you know, it was destructive in some ways, and it was not healthy in some ways, even though I was having a blast. I think it's more about trying to deal with stuff right away when you notice it. You know, I let things go so to the point where, you know, I didn't know what was going on, and I didn't catch anything because I didn't know what it was. And so I think it's more about, you know, when I was feeling, in my case, because I live with bipolar, I have manic episodes and depressive episodes. So depression was just me feeling really low and awful and upset and these things, but I thought they were connected more to specifically to my private, my public life and my private life. And I also didn't realize that the manic episodes were, I just thought it was just this like amazing, charismatic, funny, full of life, excitable. But I think that I wasn't recognizing that the behavior I was involved with and undertaking was beyond that. It was above what you call a normal scale of excitement or euphoria. So if I'd known that earlier, if I caught it, if someone around me had kind of maybe said, hey, look, like, I think you have to be really aware that when something doesn't feel quote unquote normal, to reach out at that point or to at least examine yourself. And I was oblivious. I was, like I said in the book, I was blindsided. I had no idea even what bipolar was. I'd heard the word, didn't even know the checklist for it.
And there are some real maybe evolutions you can get a sense of in the book, all through a punk rock lens. But like at one point you write that that you were a guy who thought mindfulness was a scam sold in grocery store magazines. and now you're doing breathing exercises while listening to punk rock to ground yourself. Can you tell me about maybe that process?
When I was beaten down into dust, I didn't know whether I was going to live or die. I was didn't know what was going on. I was having these horrible, horrible mood episodes after my mental health crisis, which, you know, a psychotic break where, you know, basically you feel like you've been hammered by a cinder block over the head. And so I need to figure something out. And I tried everything. I mean, it's not a question of me getting out of the hospital and being like, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to start this wellness plan and do this and this and this and yoga. And that's not the case at all. It took me 2.5 to 3 years to figure out how I was even going to make this thing work. And, you know, medication was a very great part of that but it also took a long time to settle. And I was like, this medication sucks. It's not working. And I think ultimately it was just getting to the place where I accepted my condition was the first major, major piece. You know, okay, I'm living with this condition. I'm going to live with it for the rest of my life. I'm going to take medication every day for the rest of my life. I'm going to deal with these mood episodes. It's not going to go away. I'm not going to be able to fix it. It's not going to be cured. It's going to be here. And once I accepted that, I was able to really look at the behaviors and the structure and the routines. When COVID hit, it really helped a lot because I was able to figure out a routine, you know, because things slow down so much. And I think routine, what they call circadian rhythm therapy or social rhythm therapy was the, I don't want to say savior, but it was the real like protector or the person that, the thing that really raised me up and gave me a chance to live in stability, relative stability, which is where I am now.
You also talk a lot about some of the language surrounding mental health in your book. There's one point where you're having a conversation about, should we use the word maybe mental health crisis or mental health breakdown? There are a number of other things. Could you just tell me some of your thoughts on the language?
Yeah, the pathologized language is something that comes from the medical industry and the psychiatric industry. And I don't think it really fits with me, at least. And I know a lot of folks who also say it doesn't fit for them. Using terms like mental health breakdown or I had a nervous breakdown, well, that's not very empowering, is it? You know, you have a nervous breakdown and now you're, I was down in dust and lots of people get down into the rubble of having a quote unquote breakdown. But ultimately for me, it was a crisis and now I'm kind of over that crisis and there could be a crisis again at some point. I mean, I can't guarantee I'm not going to go into another crisis, but to say it's a breakdown then implies that, okay, you're just completely crumbled and broken. You have to work your way back up. And it's not really fair when you're living on a continuum of potentially ups and downs, crisis here, stability for 6 years, another crisis. Like it, to say you have a breakdown doesn't work for me. I mean, some of the other stuff is, you know, the idea of recovery. Well, you know, what are you recovering? Where are you trying to go from the recovery? You're trying to get back to the way you were before you had a crisis. What if you were in peril at that point? I don't want to go back to the way I was before I was in crisis. I want to figure out how to change and be, you know, a better person. And so the language of transformation came up in the book. You know, and even just the difference between saying mental illness and saying mental health condition. I don't consider myself to be ill or diseased or disordered. I just consider myself to have this condition that I'm living with. And it doesn't mean that I have any less a chance of being well than anybody else. I just got to maybe work on it a bit harder.
And you also, throughout the book, we've talked a bit about the tour, but framed around that are a number of conversations you've had with other punks about some of their mental health journeys on your podcast, Scream Therapy. For folks who haven't taken a listen to that, what do you think are the big things, the biggest common threads that emerged from those conversations, talking to other punks in the same scene about mental health?
Well, we talked about it at the top about punk rock saved my life. I don't know how many people said that during the interviews, and it was just a real, you know, heart warmer every time that people said it. My very first podcast interview, the person said it, and I was like, okay, well, obviously I'm on the right track here. I didn't know if it was, when you start something out, a project, I mean, I didn't know that it was as big of a connection as it is. You're sort of feeling around and, you know, I want to do punk rock and mental health podcast. Well, is there something here? Am I going to run out of guests in 5 episodes? And now I've done about 70. You don't know. And so to have that person validate what I was trying to achieve with the podcast within the first 10, 15 minutes by saying punk rock saved my life, what was amazing. It definitely comes up a lot in the book as well. I think that the book is more centered around their stories, but also how it ties into the thesis of the book, which is that punk rock is and mental health are symbiotic and that punk rock is therapeutic for mental health. I think the podcast is a bit more of a conversation, well, obviously podcast style, where it just sort of goes on. And whereas the book really zeroes in on where this person is and you know, how punk rock fits in with that.
This is People First Radio. My guest is Jason Schurz. We're talking about his new book, Scream Therapy, A Punk Journey Through Mental Health. Part of the book follows Schurz on a 2018 punk tour of Vancouver Island that included stops at Nanaimo's The Nanaimo Bar and Gabriola Island's School Pub. You also talked to someone who's in Kitchener-Waterloo, an expert in just community music. Is a lot of what people get out of punk rock a sense of togetherness, a sense of community? Like, what particularly about punk rock is kind of the added juice to that sense of community?
Well, when you walk into a punk show and right away people are there to say hi, to talk to you about their favorite bands, to give you a high five. I was scared to go to my first show. It was in Vancouver when I was 19, and I had jitters. I was really afraid that it wasn't going to live up to the expectations that I placed on it, because of course here in Pal River there wasn't any shows. So I'd spent, you know, several years just listening to the music and not going to any shows. And then walking through the door and right away just feeling like, well, the first thing is you get an X on your hand, right? A black X, and you're like, well, what's this? And they're like, oh, well, this means that you're part of us, or whatever the person said at the door. And it's like, okay, cool. But yeah, you see people that are, you know, wearing the same kinds of band t-shirts that you do. You're seeing people that are, you know, smiling and excited, and they're there, and you're in the mosh pit with them, and they're helping you, you know, when you fall down, they pick you back up. And that's a really rare thing in society. You know, I think there's obviously a lot of subcultures that are like that, that are very supportive of each other. And I'm not saying punk is necessarily like a one of a kind anomaly of culture or community, but from my perspective, it was the one that fit for me. And I think the people that I know in the scene, and there's, you know, I've met thousands and thousands of punks over the years, they all have that common feeling of being stoked and feeling like they can be who they want to be, and it's not going to be looked upon as, you're not wearing the right thing, or you're not saying the right thing. You know, I think punk rock's very open and accepting, and I think it's been really good to accept marginalized folks over the years, even though, you know, I mean, all subcultures in some ways are predominantly, non-marginalized folks. But I think from, you know, that's a misconception about punk rock, because it's all kind of, you know, white, male, dominant culture. And really it's not, from my perspective. Of course, I'm coming from that same place of privilege, but I think punk rock is, if you don't know where to go and you don't belong or fit in or feel like you belong, and you're just kind of a weirdo freak running through life being like, why am I, no one else understands me. You walk through the door of a punk show or you pick up a record by a punk band, and right away there's identification of, okay, well, maybe there's something here for me, you know, at least maybe I should just try it on and see how it goes. And then of course, for someone like me, you know, I've been part of the scene now for more than 30 years. So obviously it fit for me.
Yeah. You really get a sense of some of what you're talking about with the inclusivity piece. Listening to some of the songs that you mention in the book, I guess, maybe, do you think there's a misconception just because, you know, punk music is kind of loud that people don't necessarily, people think maybe, oh, they're yelling at me and that makes me scared, instead of maybe they're yelling at the establishment and injustice?
For sure. Yeah, I think that is. I think the loudness and the anger and the chaoticness of the music does turn people off. But I mean, for that matter, there's forms of music that turn me off too. But yeah, I think people do miss the message sometimes that punk rock isn't about being violent, and it's not saying I want to kill you. It's more talking about the things that it wants to rally against and injustices in the world. And there's always exceptions. There's some punk bands that sing about stuff that I don't agree with at all. But, you know, I remember first time I heard Propagandhi, and they're from a punk band from Winnipeg. And, you know, inside the CD cover was anti-sexist, pro-gay, vegan friendly. I was like, wow, like this is, wow, someone can say this on their CD. There's really that sense of they're doing it. They're saying that thing that I want to say. It makes it okay. And that's, I think, missed with a lot of people that listen to it or hear it. You know, some of their, maybe their friends puts it on, or their teenage kid is listening to it, or they stumble past a bar that's playing punk, and what the heck is this? And there's a lot of a disconnect there, I think.
It almost feels like you need to be introduced to it. In like in the book, there are, I guess, a number of these you could look at as sacred moments. Like earlier you were talking about the youth showing up to the Cortez show and that feels special. Or in your life when you were younger and someone, you know, put on Black Sabbath for you for the first time as kind of a gateway into heavier music and later punk. Can you tell me about just that, maybe the initiation into punk moment?
For me?
For you, or just in general?
For anybody. Well, one of the people in the book, Mike Friedman, who's a counselor, doctor, psychologist, he talked about being introduced to punk when he was in his late 30s. He never really knew much about it, and he was introduced to it by a friend, and he basically got into a band and started screaming in a band. But the point that he makes is, you know, what would my life have been if I hadn't have found this in my 30s? You know, I was always searching for something, and then I found it and it just clicked. And, you know, looking back, he's like, how did I survive all those years of just being miserable and not knowing what I was supposed to be doing and sitting in front of the TV after 60-hour week, and not having that community or place to go and enjoy life? And so I think the initiation, whether it's at 13 years old or 50 years old, is feeling like things make sense, feeling like you have something to hold on to. And that, of course, turns into record collecting and going to shows and all those things that come with punk rock. But a lot of people will find the punk rock ethos in their lives much later. I mean, you hear about people who quit their jobs when they're, you know, in their 40s, 50s, 60s, because they just can't take it anymore. And then they go and sail the world and they do their own thing. And to me, that's punk rock.
I wanted to also ask more generally in society about the way we address mental health issues. You wrote, we need tasked action plans for addressing mental health issues. This face value, are you okay stuff isn't doing the trick. Can you tell me more about what you think we can do better?
I think as a whole, we really have to stop falling into the patterns or the cliches that we have for so many years, where we'll do this Mental Health Awareness Week campaign, which is actually just recently, and there's not a lot of staying power there. You know, it goes away for another year. For me, obviously, Mental Health Day is every day because I live with it every day. And I think that's the case for, it is the case for folks that have mental health conditions, of which, you know, 1 in 4 people have at least some sort of mental health condition. I would argue that's more than that because, you know, like we haven't talked to everybody. So I think it's a question of really realizing that we can't just help people or give them advice, or we can't just, you know, say, oh, we understand. I understand what you're going through. You know, oh, I have mood swings too. That's not the same as having bipolar. I have days that I'm really feeling depressed. Well, that's not the same as having clinical depression. I think we need to understand that these are conditions that need to be treated in a way that isn't just normalized, but also isn't pathologized on the other side so much that these people like me feel like we're patients, you know, that we're being like taken care of all the time. We need to have some empowerment as well. So it's a fine balance between, you know, not being like understanding at all, being too understanding and like trying to take on this, this burden that people hold as if you're able to solve their problems, which I think is a really bad way of doing it. It doesn't help the person that's trying to take it on. It doesn't help the person that lives with the burden either, you know? So I think as far as funding and programs and all those things, it kind of goes over my head. I don't really rally for a certain organization. I just don't have that in me really. I just have to live my life and be good to the people around me. I think there's a culture of not being good to people around you, you know, and that's why I got off of social media. There's a culture of being awful towards each other and not taking time to actually get to know each other and to empathize with each other and to ask, you know, okay, so how are you doing? Well, where do we go from there? You know, we say, oh, we're fine, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. And then the day goes on, but you're not going to say, I feel like I'm going to die. You're not going to say like, I want to die. You're not going to say, I'm feeling so anxious that I can't even leave my house, but I'm here at the grocery store and you're asking me if I'm okay. And I'm saying, yes, you know, like, how are you doing? I'm fine, but go back home and crawl under the blankets again. So A, we're being awful towards each other as a culture. B, we're not taking the time to really get to know each other, and we're not being nice to each other, essentially.
So what do you think maybe one person could do to not contribute to that culture of being awful to each other?
Don't sit behind your computer and look for trouble would be one. Be nice to someone that you don't know. Be nice to a person that maybe has said something or has acted a certain way or dresses a certain way that you don't like for whatever reason. Get rid of your own biases for a minute or two and take time to really open up to somebody and see, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt. Way more easy if you're not online, because you're not seeing a lot of that conflict or chaos that goes on. But just taking time to give people some empathy and some, I want to say love, give them some love. Come on, peace, happiness, and love. Punk rock style.
If we were standing there all metaphorically 13 at cool older Jason's house, what would the record he would hand to us be?
The one record? You're really asking me for one record? I don't hesitate. It would be Fugazi. They're a band from Washington, D.C. Probably my favorite band of all time. Just going to say it, even though there's so many. A record called In on the Kill Taker is completely mind-blowing, completely ahead of its time, musically, socially, politically. And that would be the one that I would let them drop the needle on the wax and pay it forward from the guy that let me drop the needle onto Black Sabbath's first album.
Jason, thank you so much for taking the time to discuss.
Thanks a lot, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Jason Schurz on his new book, Scream Therapy, A Punk Journey Through Mental Health. Schurz will be at Window Seat Books in Nanaimo this Sunday at 4:30 for a launch event. He'll be in Victoria at Camus Books and Info Shop Tuesday at 7. Now, we drop the needle. Here is the lead track off of Fugazi's 1993 album, In on the Kill Taker. This is Facet Squared.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
A group of housing providers are saying we need to tweak some of our systems and attitudes around supportive housing. In a column that appeared in the Victoria Times Colonist last month, they called for changes to the Residential Tenancy Act and identified a tendency towards firefighting rather than systemic investments in solutions. The column came from the CEOs and executive directors of four different groups that provide housing: the Aboriginal Coalition to End Homelessness Society, Our Place Society, the Victoria Kool-Aid Society, and Pacifica Housing. Two of those CEOs, Kathy Stinson of the Victoria Kool-Aid Society and Carolina Ibarra of Pacifica Housing, join me to share more on these issues. Carolina, what prompted you to reach out to the public like that?
The group of supportive housing providers has been meeting monthly for just over a year now, just to, you know, share best practices and discuss our challenges. And one of the things we've been discussing is just how supportive housing in particular and homelessness is viewed in the community, and all the different voices and criticisms, concerns. And we just wanted to make sure that we brought our voice to the table as well.
And so before we get into discussing what some of those concerns may be, I think it's important we define for people what exactly we're talking about when we say supportive housing. In the column, you wrote that supportive housing began as a response to a range of support needs. It now serves a very specific demographic of people who require the lowest barrier housing and supports. Kathy, could you maybe explain a bit more about what we mean when we say supportive housing and what it looks like?
Sure. So supportive housing, I would say, has gone through a shift in the last few years, and particularly just before the pandemic. Maybe starting back with the opioid crisis, what was then defined as the opioid crisis and now is referenced as a drug poisoning crisis. So I would say for the last maybe 7 to 8 years, it's been shifting towards working with folks with really critical challenges. So folks that have mental illness, that have substance use challenges, that have been chronically homeless. So maybe they get housed for a little while, but they're not able to keep that housing. And so they cycle through the shelter system. And part of that's driven by the lack of housing. There simply just isn't enough housing out there. And so really making sure that the supportive housing that was available was going to the people with the highest needs. So really a triage system for those that are most challenged. And Caroline, I don't know if you would add to that.
Yeah, I agree with Kathy. It's basically people with a history of chronic homelessness, mental health, addiction issues, and more people with some complex physical challenges as well. And so we have still less and less some sites that are very lightly staffed. And we used to hear, oh, well, it's really important to have those light supports for people who are almost ready for independent living. When realistically, we can support them in the private market. The people who need supportive housing need pretty intensive supports.
Yeah, you also wrote that over the past several years, the complexity of needs of our clients has grown. Could either of you just expand maybe a bit more on that point?
Yeah, I can start. And I think it's really this narrowing of the definition of who is able to get into supportive housing. So it used to be that people with a range of support needs from very, very minor to severe would be living in supportive housing. But because of the lack of housing, and because there's more and more people that seem to have challenges, and that's a result of many things, a lot of systemic issues that have grown over the years. Now we're talking about people that have, you know, chronic substance use issues, untreated illness, more physical issues as well. And perhaps I've lost the thread of the original question. So Caroline, you want to jump in there?
I'm relatively new to the supportive housing space compared to Kathy. I came from affordable housing, independent living. And so I don't have quite as much of the historical context, but from our staff, both in Victoria and Nanaimo, I am hearing that they did more regularly have people who just needed some light supports, but that right now, just the compounding issues that they're facing is really noticeable. Just that everyone coming through the door needs quite significant supports. And the thing that I've been hearing more and more is the physical disabilities as well. So a lot of challenges with mobility and other just health issues. So it is much more complex in general.
And we've heard over the past year the idea of a new model of specifically complex care being rolled out across the province. Could you maybe provide some context on what the intersection is, how supportive housing is different from complex care? Is it the same thing?
I think supportive housing providers believe that complex care really is just very well-resourced supportive housing, right? It's supportive housing that has all of the attending supports that you need to really give people that have those chronic issues, those long-standing issues, an opportunity to kind of work through them. So well-staffed, well-connected to both primary health care, mental health care, trauma recovery, substance use recovery programs. programs, all of the gamut of things that, that people need to move beyond what brings them to supportive housing in the first place.
Agreed. I mean, we have some sites that one would say are like complex care, even though they're not part of the program, like NICAO and Nanaimo. We have physicians and nurses that visit. It's fully staffed. Our staff connect people to those resources. So it really is a lot more intensive than some of the other sites that have less resources. And I don't know that complex care has really been defined in BC. There's some funding that's been allocated, and I know the different health authorities are trying to still roll out what that means, and it's different across the board. But there hasn't been housing attached to that funding. I think in the new round, there might be. So it's hard. It's a very gray area, but I agree with Kathy. I think most of us feel that complex care really is properly resourced supportive housing.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Kathy Stinson and Carolina Ibarra, CEOs of the Victoria Kool-Aid Society and Pacifica Housing, respectively. Both organizations provide supportive housing on Vancouver Island. We're focusing on some of the issues related to supportive housing they identified in a column that they helped pen. It recently appeared in the Victoria Times Colonist. In the column, you also wrote that we need a legal regulatory structure that's adequate for the service provided, and said that the Residential Tenancy Act doesn't provide that. What's missing from our framework when it comes to effective supportive housing?
So, you know, the RTA is really geared towards people that can live independently, that are fully functional and understand that they're both their rights and their responsibilities through the act. And I think that the challenge is that many of the folks coming into supportive housing need a lot of additional support and don't really understand the complexities of what's required of them to maintain a tenancy in a private market landlord situation. So they would not be able to compete in that private market. But yet right now within the supportive housing framework, there's still a requirement that supportive housing providers follow that RTA. And so it's really challenging to support your tenants when part of the RTA requires that you be a good neighbor, that you don't disturb the neighbor beside you. And so there's a lot of negotiating that goes on in supportive housing about how to balance the rights of different residents within a building.
Yeah, I would just add to that in the same context, it just doesn't offer flexibility, kind of fails everyone. So the residents do have very little rights under program agreements, which is what our operating agreements typically say we have to enter into with the resident in terms of being able to do evictions very quickly. There's not like a huge process. And if they have to go to the residential tenancy branch, a lot of our residents just don't have the capacity to prepare to defend themselves. So in that sense, it's failing them quite significantly. And then on the other hand, for providers, because supportive housing does work with a population that's a lot more vulnerable and facing different challenges and maybe haven't had a history of knowing what healthy relationships are, let alone tenancies, we need to be able to be flexible. And that might mean, as some providers mentioned in a recent workshop we have, temporarily relocating someone just to change space and before they come back so that they can, settle or regulate. Or sometimes we do need to be able to remove someone from a site when they're not suited to it in terms of behavior such as violence in order to protect the rest of the community. And the RTB does not allow us to do that quickly. We need to go through a very long process. So we need something that balances things better in the sense that the residents of supportive housing can have their rights protected. We can be flexible so that eviction is not our only option, but that if it comes to health and safety of our staff and other residents, that we are able to act. And at this moment, the Residential Tenancy Act does not really solve any of that.
So in a case where someone is evicted from supportive housing, what happens?
Well, there's a range of things that can happen. Certainly, eviction is always the last resort of any supportive housing provider, and we've usually gone down many different paths before we take that option, unless there's some really physical violence that occurs and we have to act more quickly. But we do work with our partner providers. Sometimes it's just a particular milieu within a building where the individual can't get along with its neighbors, but might be able to get along in another building. And so we're able to have a transfer to a different supportive housing environment. Sometimes it means going back to the shelter system for a period of time. So, we're fortunate at Kool-Aid that we operate a couple of different shelters and are able to make space within the shelter to accommodate an individual coming back to that situation.
In the column, you wrote that there's a hesitancy to make systematic investments in solutions while funds are lost on reactive, figurative, and real firefighting. Could you give me some examples of what you're talking about there with the firefighting?
I think, we know what works. And if we take Nikkei, which is in Nanaimo, as an example, where it started and where it is now is very different. So where it started, there was a rush to fill the building. The building wasn't finished when people started moving in. There were questions about how much staffing, whereas now we have a system. We have the physical infrastructure, for better or worse, although the building could be much, much better. We've got the amount of staffing and we've got the healthcare, and we know how that works. But in some of the other sites, there's this hesitancy to fund full staffing. I heard from another journalist, everyone says how much is enough staffing and nobody really knows. But we do more or less know, 24/7. For a certain amount of people, provide security, provide supports. But sometimes that staffing or that funding won't occur until there is something bad happen, the physical assault, violence. And then after that, the funding comes. And it's not necessary. We could just avoid all of that and have better outcomes if the investment was done up front and the things that we know work. Same with the physical infrastructure. Sometimes fire systems, if we're going to go to the literal fires, need to be upgraded. And going through that process to get approval is long and painful unless there's a fire. And of course, by that point, whether it's after something bad happens in terms of violence or a fire or a wall starts to crumble, it's much more expensive to then replace it. But those are funds to fixing and replacing that are not going to just investing in the staffing up front and the maintenance and the proper fire systems. Does that make sense? It's like the money is spent either way. It's just either spent in doing things properly up front to ensure better outcomes and more safety, or it comes afterwards when much more money is required and something negative has already occurred.
Yeah, and I could just elaborate on that a little. I mean, I think the physical space is so important. And that's why when we learn something new every time we open a new building, and we know how buildings should be put together for optimum results. I mean, you need staff right at the front door. You need a double door system to prevent unwanted guests from getting into the building. The budgeting system that we work within is fairly archaic. I mean, BC Housing has always had this system of manageable versus non-manageable costs. And things like maintenance have always been on that manageable side. But with the change in acuity of the people that we're serving, maintenance is a huge ongoing issue for service providers. Tenants are really hard on their units. And, when there's turnover of a unit, basically a unit probably has to be redone way more often than it would be in the private market. And so recognizing that those ongoing maintenance costs just need to be there in order to keep the building in really good shape and make sure that you're providing that quality space for individuals. If you're trying to help someone get to a better place, then they need to be moving into a unit that is, something that you would be proud to live in if it was your unit moving into.
This is People First Radio. I'm in conversation with the CEOs of two supportive housing providers on Vancouver Island, Kathy Stinson of the Victoria Kool-Aid Society, and Carolina Ibarra of Pacifica Housing. Our conversation is informed by a column they wrote, along with two other housing providers, that appeared in the Victoria Times Colonist in April. You also wrote that there's a lot of good work happening and many examples of phenomenal success, but we seem to focus on what is not working. Could you share with me maybe what some of those successful examples are?
I think we all do, but I'll jump in with some of ours. So in Victoria, we have a site called Camas Gardens, which is purpose-built, fully staffed, and it's a beautiful site. People visit it, and they usually can't believe that that is where we house the highest acuity people in our portfolio. And people are successful usually until they're much older. So we've got even an aging population living there. It's the same with Uplands Walk in Nanaimo. Purpose-built. A lot of some of our residents are what we would consider seniors in that population. And it has its challenges, like any site or any program where we serve people that are vulnerable and have mental health and addiction issues, among other challenges. But overall, there's a very tight-knit community. The community, including the residents and the staff, maintain the building through, they have a cleaning program. So it is like the poster of what supportive housing is supposed to be, in my opinion. Nikeo has come a long way, and I'm always incredibly inspired and impressed. That's the site, modular site on Labio, which I always tell everyone that I'm horrified and inspired, and I never thought I could feel that way in the same sentence, in the same space. But I'm inspired by the staff and the residents and the challenges they've been through. I mean, some people are homeless like 8 to 15 years before they get there, and they stabilize in that environment. The only thing holding us back there is the built environment, that the buildings are not good for supporting that population. But those are all really great successes. People who we've heard say that person is unhousable, they cannot be in that environment, they come in and they stabilize and they begin to thrive. And the fact that there's so many different types where we could move people to something that's a better fit, is something that I wish that was spoken about a little bit more, because it's a testament to the resilience of our residents, to the huge effort and expertise of our staff, and just things can work out well, even in difficult situations. Sorry, I'll turn it over to Kathy. I'm very passionate about that part.
Yeah, I mean, Kool-Aid's been operating supportive housing since 1991, we opened our first building. And, you know, we have some tenants in some of our older buildings that are still there from the beginning. They came in and maybe they had a mental illness, but they're on medication and they're able to keep that illness under control. But they're still living at that poverty line level. And so they need that ongoing support just to make sure that they stay stable. But we've had other folks that have come into supportive housing. They've been stabilized. They get connected to the medical supports that they need or the recovery supports that they need. And we've been able to help them move on to market housing, sometimes with a subsidy and sometimes without. You know, people have moved on to employment and full lives. You know, we've had stories of people that have been in supportive housing and have gone on to get their lives stable, to marry, to have children. We hear from those folks every now and then. So, you know, there's lots of good stories that come out of supportive housing. And there's the ability now with some other programs opening up where shelter rate rental opportunities are available in buildings where no supports are offered, where people that have been stabilized but still require that deep subsidy can move and thrive. And so those stories are happening all the time, but you know, the media tends to focus on the more sensational ones where, you know, Vic PD gets involved because somebody's violent within a building or something like that. And so that's the challenge, that the good stories stay kind of hidden away.
So if there are people out there who aren't really connected to the supportive housing world and maybe are either skeptical of, say, having a supportive housing building in their neighborhood, or maybe are skeptical about some of the things they hear about, maybe some of the behind the scenes work going on in the supportive housing bureaucracy. What message would you like to communicate to them?
Well, I would encourage them to come and speak to any one of the supportive housing providers. We offer tours through our buildings at various times. We have residents who are happy to speak as ambassadors who are thriving within supportive housing. We have neighbors that appreciate us and are willing to speak out as well. So, you know, I think the stories are there. It's about how to seek them out. And I mean, I think one of the challenges with some of the stories in the media is, you know, if a former resident is speaking out about an experience, we can't really speak to that ourselves. We're bound by confidentiality, and so we can't necessarily give the other side of a story, even though there often is another side to a story.
I echo what Kathy says. We are starting to do barbecues and events at our sites where we invite the community. So I would encourage people to actually join us and meet us, as in the providers, the staff, and the residents, to get a better sense, and do ask questions, reach out, ask questions, and give feedback, because we're always willing to work with the neighbors to try and address any concerns. And what I do say to the public is, when there's new supportive housing coming potentially to your neighborhood, rather than being concerned about there being supportive housing, ask and advocate that it has proper staffing and resources. That really, and proper building, that really is what will make the difference. It's not whether it's a supportive housing site or not. It's that it's properly resourced. And I think every single operator agrees with that and would welcome that from the community, because we are in the same boat. We want these programs to work in every neighborhood so we can house the people who need us so much.
Kathy Stinson is the CEO of the Victoria Kool-Aid Society. Carolina Ibarra is the CEO of Pacifica Housing. That is it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.